From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Pahong. An Australian Senate inquiry into serious allegations and conditions at the Nauru Detention Center has heard medical staff were told not to report psychological health problems suffered by asylum seekers. The inquiry was launched following the release of the Moss report, which detailed allegations of physical and sexual abuse of asylum seekers by guards and staff. Mary Baines reports.
The former Mental Health Director for International Health and Medical Services on Nauru, Peter Young, says there is an unwillingness by the Immigration Department to accept asylum seekers have genuine mental health issues relating to their time in detention.
When it came to mental health issues, we were repeatedly told that we're making recommendations about people's mental health and the harms that had accrued to their mental health while they're in Nauru, that we should not say that in the report. It was unacceptable to put in reports to the department that people's mental health had been harmed by being in detention in Nauru.
Who said to you that you shouldn't put that in a report?
The department's chief medical officer.
How often did that occur?
Several times.
Dr. Young told the inquiry the Immigration Department is reluctant to send asylum seekers to Australia to get medical care because it undermines the process of offshore detention and allows them to have access to lawyers. He says medical recommendations were frequently delayed or not accepted by the department, and medical staff were asked to change reports.
If there was a case of a person that had a recommendation that they needed to be moved off the island and treated within, say, 48 hours, and that period had expired, what would generally happen would be that you would be asked to write another recommendation following that.
You say generally. How often would you say this occurred?
Quite frequently.
The inquiry also heard from two former Save the Children staff, Victoria Vibhakar and Kirsty Diello, who both raised concerns around the reporting of sexual assaults at the centre. Ms. Vibhakar says there are inadequate policies to prevent and respond to crimes against children on Nauru, even when children are identified as being at high risk of abuse. She told the inquiry about an 8-year-old girl with the pseudonym Mia who had been sexually and physically assaulted at the camp.
Although Mia had a father living in Australia able to care for her safely, she was detained for more than 7 months after disclosing sexual assault. She eventually planned to take her own life. Despite the risk to her physical and mental health and that she may have been subject to ongoing sexual assault that she was too afraid to disclose, the Department of Immigration and Border Protection did not remove her until her caregiver attempted suicide.
Ms. Diello says the Immigration Minister Scott Morrison and the department were made aware of sexual abuse allegations of a child, but the government did not act.
On the 16th of November 2013, a child was sexually assaulted by a government contractor. That information was investigated by Wilson Security and an incident report was completed. That was forwarded on to the Department of Immigration. And in December 2013, I asked the Save the Children manager, director, if that incident report had been forwarded on to the Minister for Immigration and Border Protection. I was advised that the Minister had seen that incident report.
Ms. Diello says she was forced to conduct an assessment of the child who had been assaulted at the centre under a tree.
I was responsible for doing an assessment, a psychosocial assessment of the child after he'd been assaulted and of his mother. I had to carry out that assessment in an open space under a tree in the camp because there was no private facilities to have that conversation with that child.
The inquiry also heard from the Department of Immigration. Its secretary, Michael Pizzullo, denies Dr. Young's allegations the department rewrote medical recommendations which advised an asylum seeker be treated in Australia.
People are transferred medically, either to Australia or to other places. And generally speaking, the clinical advice is taken. We certainly have quite a number of family groups, children, adults here in Australia. So I don't understand how it is that the claim can be made that we don't accept advice around transferring people from Nauru. Equally, where it's possible to augment or increase medical capability on Nauru, we will.
Mr. Pizzullo was also asked about what the inquiry called disturbing allegations about the conditions of the camps, including that detainees lived in mouldy tents, had no adequate access to sanitary products, shoes, water, medical care and beds. He says the department will spend hundreds of millions of dollars on the Nauru Detention Centre this year, but could not give an exact figure.
We provide effectively a hospital that would do very well in a small Australian country town. The sort of 24/7 medical care would be, frankly, well regarded in any remote rural location. As to allegations that people are without shoes or beds, unless I can be presented with the specifics, my instinct is that that can't be right because the centre is well provided for and well provisioned.
The department said of 50 abuse cases on Nauru referred to local police since September 2013, 5 charges have been laid and 2 convictions recorded. It said a number of cases are still under investigation, but could not reveal how many. It also could not say how many of those cases involved children. The Senate committee is expected to reveal its findings this month. This is Mary Baines.
The head of the Immigration Department has fronted a Senate inquiry into the Australian-funded Immigration Detention Centre on Nauru. He has a robust defence of the conditions there and the response to a series of allegations of rape and sexual abuse. The top immigration bureaucrat told the inquiry that the department has referred 50 allegations of assault to the Nauru police since late 2012. Only 2 ended with convictions. He also defended the hospital's standard of health services on the island, saying that they were comparable to small regional hospitals in Australia. From Canberra, Petta Donald reports.
The Senate inquiry into the Australian-funded detention centre on Nauru has heard damning allegations about the circumstances and conditions there. Today, there were more. Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
You reference a 4-year-old girl. You reference an 8-year-old girl. You reference a 2-year-old boy. You reference a single mother who was reported to be harassed by guards in her tent at night, and expecting sexual favours. The list goes on.
The inquiry was hearing from Victoria Vabaka, a former senior child protection worker at the centre with Save the Children. She spoke of a 4-year-old girl whose behaviour was consistent with sexual abuse. An 8-year-old boy was allegedly sexually assaulted by 2 adult asylum seekers, witnessed by a Commonwealth contractor. And there was a woman she spoke of who felt unsafe at night.
She had a very high needs, special needs child, and she often would need help in, you know, helping to manage his behaviour or with parenting, and she began feeling extremely unsafe because she felt that that people that had provided her assistance in the daytime, and these were both Commonwealth contracted employees and adult asylum seekers, were then approaching her tent at nighttime or wanting sexual favours from her, and she felt continually unsafe.
She told the inquiry in all cases except for 1, incident reports had been logged. This afternoon, the Secretary of the Immigration Department, Michael Bozzullo, had his chance to respond. He told the inquiry that since late 2012, 50 cases of assault of adults and children have been referred to Nauruan police.
Going back to September of 2012, we have incident reports that are germane to that topic, and that's why the number of referrals that we've made to the Nauru police force over the time since, 2.5 years, amount to some 50.
Of those, 5 charges have been laid, 2 convictions recorded, leaving 45 cases under investigation. The inquiry has also heard evidence critical of the standard of medical care on the island and a reluctance to fly asylum seekers off the island to receive proper care. Mr. Bozzullo says efforts are being made to work with the Nauruan government to improve health services, including in the case of an 8-year-old boy with a badly broken arm, whose case has received recent media coverage.
The answer can't just simply always be in the minds of the relevant clinician, well, there is nothing that can be done in these circumstances. You have to move the person to another place, because the answer could well be in those circumstances, well, we'll actually provide the support on island. And indeed, we recently did that with the case, the rather well-publicised case of the young boy who broke his arm. Yes. It's been repaired and he underwent surgery in recent days.
Mr. Bozzullo defended the standards at the local hospital.
We provide effectively a hospital that would do very well in a small Australian country town. The sort of 24/7 medical care would be, frankly, well regarded in any remote rural location.
We now go to India, where the government has barred an Australian Greenpeace campaigner from entering the country in its latest action against the environmental group. An Australian man who had a valid visa was refused entry to India's Bangalore airport and had his passport seized. In recent months, the Narendra Modi government has denied both entry and exit to members of Greenpeace and has frozen the organization's bank accounts. Our South Asia correspondent Stephanie March reports from New Delhi.
As a campaigner for Greenpeace International, Aaron Gray Block travels the world for work. He describes what happened to him on Saturday night in India as a surreal experience.
I was stopped by immigration officials at Bangalore Airport in southern India and was denied entry to India despite having a valid business visa.
What reason did the immigration officials give you for refusing you entry to India?
There was no formal reason given. I was stopped at customs and my passport was seized, and I was told later on that I'd been refused permission to land in India, and I was put on a plane back to Australia, Sydney via Kuala Lumpur.
Aaron Gray Block says his passport was returned to him when he arrived in Kuala Lumpur. A Home Ministry official has told the ABC Mr. Gray Block was denied entry because his name was on the Government of India's blacklist, but he refused to answer further questions. Aaron Gray Block again.
We see this as a part of the systematic crackdown on civil society in general and Greenpeace in particular. It's a democratic right for the free movement of people and the free movement of ideas. And I find it very unfortunate that in the current situation that I was not allowed to enter India.
In June last year, a leaked report from India's intelligence agency warned that the actions of foreign-funded NGOs like Greenpeace had been stalling development projects, costing the country between 2 and 3% in GDP growth. The growth agenda of the Indian government, led by Narendra Modi, involves building new mines and coal and nuclear-fired power stations across the country, which Greenpeace oppose. Since the report was leaked, other Greenpeace activists have been denied entry and exit from India, and in April, the government froze the group's bank accounts. Last month, the court ordered the government allow Greenpeace access to some of its funds, but the refusal to allow Aaron Gray Block to enter shows the group's problems are far from over. Divya Raghunandan is Greenpeace India's program director.
We feel like it's multiple forms of harassment. Aaron is the latest to that list. And I think that this is continuing, and unfortunately it's continuing without any space for dialogue or conversation with the Home Ministry. They're refusing to engage in any conversation.
Subhash Mittal, a chartered accountant who works with NGOs in India, says the government does have domestic support for the crackdown.
There seems to be a huge constituency in India which seems to feel that these NGOs using foreign money are just, creating more trouble for the country and for the government. So the government seems to have a constituency to support itself as far as domestically concerned.
And Greenpeace India is not the government's only target. Nearly 9,000 Indian non-government organisations have had their registration cancelled by authorities.
That was Stephanie March reporting from New Delhi, India. There are more signs that China's economy is slowing. Consumer prices in China eased back in May, and prices at the factory gate also fell. Eleanor Hall speaks next to Sue Lannan. She's a financial reporter and has been covering the official figures from the Chinese government.
Well, Eleanor, we saw the latest figures out from the National Bureau of Statistics, and the Consumer Price Index in China, so consumer prices, increased 1.2% in May from a year ago. Now, that is a very weak level of inflation in China, and we've been seeing that for some time. And also, the Producer Price Index, that's prices at the factory gate, they dropped 4.6%, and that's yet another fall. And it just all points to the picture that's been emerging over the past year of a slowing Chinese economy. The Chinese government expects growth this year in 2015 to be around 7%, and it's likely that it will employ more stimulus measures. We've already seen a number of interest rate cuts. There's been some relaxing of restrictions on property borrowing in China. And also there is a lot of targeted stimulus that will be rolled out for infrastructure projects. So, but still, Chinese government will have, is really trying to keep growth up at around 7%.
It sounds like it'll have its work cut out for it. And Sue, there's some local economic data out relating to our earlier story about housing in Australia.
Yes, we had the latest house price housing finance data out from the Bureau of Statistics. So again, we've seen in for April, investment housing, so the value of loans to investors, rose 2.6% from March to April. So that is actually a fall on the previous month when it dropped over 6%. But it's still pretty, as you can see, a lot of robust demand by investors for housing finance, housing loans. But owner-occupier housing also rose about 3.5% over the month. So strong demand for housing.
Financial reporter Sue Lennon speaking to Eleanor Hall. An unsuccessful candidate for the president in Bougainville says he is taking legal action over the election result, alleging ballot boxes were stuffed with fake votes. At the weekend, John Momus was declared the winner of the presidential race in the autonomous region of Papua New Guinea, easily defeating eight men running against him. With preferences, he got over 51,000 votes, with second place going to Ishmael Tramana with just over 18,000. Don Wiseman speaks to Sam Koona about this case.
We are taking this matter to court because the results are just unbelievable. A person cannot score like that where he is not favored. For Momis to score that number, it is refutable. This is the new generation. It's not the old generation that used to favor Momis way back before the crisis. It's the new generation, and the favoritism of the leaders in Bougainville has shifted. And that's why today a lot of people that casted their votes, particularly in Buka, northern part of Bougainville, they are saying, where are our votes? There's a strong public pressure stating where their votes are. Looks like it has not been counted. It looks like their votes has been thrown out, and fake votes have been inserted. The true ones has been extracted out and insertion of fake votes into ballot paper. And all funny things happened during the counting.
There have been a lot of people watching the selection process. You and your colleagues in the presidential race, you had scrutineers everywhere. If there were strange things going on, why weren't they raised then?
They raised it. But the system protected the system itself. They were not able to become effective in scrutinizing the process. To start off with, the distance from the counting and recording was out of sight. You cannot actually, as a scrutineer, you cannot actually see what the name was. Only after some of us complained, then they adjusted the tables. Even then, they could hardly see how the papers, whose name was it in the paper, that they were sorting it out. To start off with, there was a problem in the distance of scrutinizing, seeing it. And when they want to raise the point, the police who were in charge discouraged them from voicing out. This is very clear because I pulled out the returning officer two times, not one time, to complain to the figures that were not reconciling. The figures in the actual tally box for constituency compared to presidential counts, they were not reconciling because those two areas, constituency and presidential, has to reconcile. And to make it worse, they did not allow for our scrutineers to bring in the initial tally, which was collected in the local areas. They were not allowed to bring that out to match it or reconcile with the process numbers. So it is strongly believed that the process has been tampered with.
These are extremely strong allegations you are making. The other side can come back to you and say, well, this is just sour grapes from people who competed and didn't compete well enough.
Well, it has to be proven in court. There is a system, you know. If you do not prove it out, then the security situation in Bougainville is at risk. That's the important point. We have to take it to court. We have a situation here.
Yes.
And if we do not address it in Bougainville, the security situation is in danger.
You're taking court action. What have you initiated so far?
Well, Actually, you are making a call right in a meeting with the lawyer, with our lawyers. There are about 9 of us, complainants, contestants, not just for presidential seat, but other areas like constituencies throughout Bougainville. We are here with the lawyer now. This is to stop people taking law into their own hands. We have to do the right thing.
Climate scientists are calling for an international system to track the effects of climate change on the Southern Ocean. Scores of scientists from a range of countries gather data on environmental changes in the region, but don't share it in a way to coordinate it. Now, at a meeting, over more than 60 scientists are gathering in Hobart to seek to change that. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
One of the scientists who is in Hobart setting up the international data sharing system is a professor of oceanography from the US, Oscar Schofield.
There is a coordinated effort across all the countries from the Antarctic managers. So those are the people who do logistics, like ship schedules, you know, medical evacuations, environmental rules. So from the logistical side, that is being done, but it doesn't exist on the science side yet, which is sad, but that's something we're going to rectify.
And how do you plan to do that?
Well, the first thing is to identify what are those high priority measurements that a scientist from any country agrees they need. And then from there, essentially trying to make the data open access. So if I feed data in to the system, I have access to all this other data.
He says all the national programs will still control their science, but the collaboration will make sure the data that is collected by each national program is available to anyone in the international science community. He says it will make a big impact on research in regions such as the West Antarctic Peninsula.
There's 25 stations along the West Antarctic Peninsula, all by different countries. And what I hope is that the measurements made at all those stations will be unified, so that we can get a comprehensive picture all the way from the north to the south to essentially follow when you melt all the ice, what happens to the biology.
Andrew Constable from the Australian Antarctic Division says the scientists will use equipment like remote-controlled floats to gain information about changes in water temperature in the Southern Ocean.
It drives the deep ocean circulation. It also is a major contributor to the drawdown of carbon from the atmosphere, and so it has a controlling influence. Also, the impacts of the Southern Ocean on the Antarctic ice sheet are such that it's going to impact on sea level rise. So these are important measurements. The other thing that's important to Australia as well is that the Southern Ocean is a great place for fishing, and so we need to understand what is going to happen to the fisheries, how the krill population is going to change, what's going to happen to the Antarctic predators.
He says many countries have ships that go down to Antarctica every year, and those ships can be used to take measurements from the ocean.
Staying in Australia, the Queensland Auditor General has handed down a damning report into the state government's management of the Great Barrier Reef. The report examined the state's efforts to reduce agricultural runoff onto the reef over the past 12 years. The Auditor General found the government's approach was haphazard and lacked urgency and purpose. It also raised questions about the accuracy of the government's assertions that the decline in water quality has been reversed. The World Wildlife Fund says that that's the case, and UNESCO, that's the United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, was misled when it declared last month not to list the Great Barrier Reef officially as being in danger. Nance Haxton reports.
Stretching more than 2,300 kilometres down Queensland's coast, the Great Barrier Reef is the world's largest coral reef system. For more than 30 years, it's been listed as a World Heritage Site. It's just over a week since UNESCO's World Heritage Committee made a preliminary decision not to list the reef as in danger, although it is keeping it on its watch list. But the Queensland Audit Office report handed down in Parliament today raises doubts about how rigorously the reef is being protected. It found that state government moves to stop agricultural runoff onto the Great Barrier Reef lacked rigour, were uncoordinated, and lacked accountability. The report also found that the government is yet to design a program responding to the reef plan that was developed 12 years ago. Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk moved to reassure people in the wake of the scathing assessment.
My government is committed to spending $100 million in improving the water quality of the Great Barrier Reef. Also, stopping the capital dredge spoil being dumped into the World Heritage Area to actually make sure that we are being responsible custodians of the reef.
She says the government will consider the report and its recommendations. The Auditor-General called for more stringent monitoring of farms and for a review of all water quality programs to ensure they're still working. But the findings that recent changes to land clearing rules increase the risk of sediment runoff and that improvement targets set in 2013 are unlikely to be achieved have incensed environmental groups. The World Wildlife Fund says the findings throw doubt on the government's assertions to UNESCO. Spokesman Nick Heath.
Australians and UNESCO have been misled in terms of the Great Barrier Reef and the claims being made by governments of pollution reduction. The Auditor General believes they could be easily misconstrued as fact. These are damning findings. Voluntary programs have not been working, and the monitoring of the reef and its water quality has been very scant. It needs to be far more comprehensive to tell us the truth about the reef's condition and health.
Queensland's Minister for the Environment and the Great Barrier Reef, Stephen Miles, says Australians have not been misled on the health of the reef.
I believe that UNESCO based their decision on the long-term sustainability plan, which is more about what we will do going forward than what we have done in the past. Look, the previous government does have a lot to answer for in terms of their approach to land clearing, and the Auditor General makes that point very, very clearly, that their willingness to allow broad-scale deforestation has probably undone any of the good work on farm or on land.
While Federal Environment Minister Greg Hunt says many of the report's recommendations have already been implemented.
It identifies many good things that have been done. It also says that there needs to be more emphasis on actual monitoring. And just today, in the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Ministerial Council, we decided and we determined there should be, there would be, and there will be more monitoring. So I think they're good recommendations, which we've already adopted.
The 21 nations on UNESCO's World Heritage Committee will make a final ruling in Germany later this month on whether to accept the recommendation that the Great Barrier Reef not be listed as in danger.
And with that report from Nance Haxton, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. If you want to listen to this program again or the past editions, just visit our website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team of Focus Asia Pacific, I'm Keith Parot, wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon. So long and take care.